Good afternoon, everyone, and David, thank you for that introduction. This is the first time that I've had the pleasure of participating in one of FINSIA's regulators' forums, and it's a great honour for me to be here. As a regulator, the Reserve Bank has responsibilities in three broad areas. The first, along with APRA, we have a broad responsibility for the stability of the financial system. Second, we have specific responsibilities in the area of payment system regulation. And third, we have responsibility for prudential supervision of Australia's clearing and settlement facilities. So this afternoon, I'd like to say a few words about each of these three areas and some of the issues that lie ahead for us. So I'll start off with the financial stability responsibility. And over recent times, there's been a tremendous amount of discussion about the risks in the Australian housing market, and the Reserve Bank published its latest analysis on this just a few weeks ago on the six-monthly financial stability review. Now, rather than go over that ground again today, I want to highlight just one issue, and that's the importance of good quality data. Now, this might seem a rather obscure issue to highlight in a forum like this, but the basis of good analysis is good data. Improvements over time in the quality and comprehensiveness of data on housing prices in Australia have helped improve the general understanding of developments in the housing market in our country. But unfortunately, recent problems with the data relating to banks' owner-occupied and investor housing credit have worked in the other direction, and they've complicated understanding of what's been going on in our housing market. Now, these data problems have arisen as lenders have taken a closer look at their housing loan books following increased regulatory scrutiny. And as the lenders have looked more closely, what they found has surprised us and, I'd have to say, to some extent, concerned us. And there are two issues that I want to draw your attention to. The first is that over the past 6 months, there have been very large upward revisions to the value of investor credit outstanding, and they've been offsetting downward revisions to owner-occupied credit. More than 10 institutions have made material revisions to their data, and of these 10, two of the large institutions have made revisions. And the scale of these revisions can be seen in this graph, which shows the stock of investor credit outstanding as reported in each of May, June and September this year. The cumulative effect of the upward revisions has been to increase the stock of investor credit outstanding by around $50 billion. That's around 10% of the stock. So according to these new data, investor loans now account for 40% of total loans outstanding, not the 35% that was reported earlier in the year. While the reasons for some of these earlier errors have been identified, in other cases the reasons are unclear, and the lenders, by and large, have not been able to provide us with comprehensive back data. So as a result, when calculating growth rates of both investor and owner-occupied housing credit, the RBA has had to make significant adjustments for what are effectively breaks in the series. The second data issue here has arisen just over the past couple of months, and it's worked in the other direction, with lenders reporting that some loans that were previously recorded as investor loans were really loans to owner-occupiers. And this is partly because when faced with the higher interest rate on investor loans, some borrowers have gone to their bank and said, well, really, they're not an investor after all. They're an owner-occupier, and so they shouldn't have to pay the higher interest rate. And our liaison with a number of lenders suggests that there are further reclassifications, perhaps on a significant scale, still to come. And the effect of these reclassifications on the growth rates can be seen in this second chart. Taken at face value, the data suggests a very, very sharp slowing in growth in investor credit and a sharp pickup in owner-occupied credit, and that's shown in the dotted lines here. However, if we make adjustments for these reclassifications, then the changes in growth rates are much less pronounced, and those adjusted series are shown in the solid lines. Now, these various data problems have reinforced our view that the supervisory focus on investing lending has been entirely appropriate. And we found it disappointing that lenders' internal systems have not been up to the task of reporting accurate data on the split between investor and owner-occupied housing loans. This issue has been discussed at the most recent meeting of the Council of Financial Regulators, and the Council members are considering what steps could and should be taken to improve the quality of data. Amongst other things, it's been decided that APRA, the Reserve Bank and the Australian Bureau of Statistics will next year undertake a thorough review of the data collected from authorised deposit-taking institutions, particularly regarding their domestic books. Now, the second issue the area I want to touch on is the RBA's payment system work. And here there are two issues in particular that are the focus over the year ahead. The first is the industry efforts to develop a new 21st century payment system for Australia. The efforts are here to a significant degree a response to the Reserve Bank's strategic review of innovation in the payment system that was concluded in 2012. While some aspects of Australia's payment system rank relatively well by global standards, the underlying architecture of some of our systems has aged and it has limited innovation. One example of this that many of you might be familiar with is that when you go to your online bank account and send a payment to another person or business, you're limited to just 18 characters in describing the payment. I think many people find this frustrating. Now, the reason for this restriction is that the entire payment instruction, including the BSB, the amount, the banks involved, and other necessary information, is limited to just 120 characters. My understanding is that the origin of this limit is the capacity of the magnetic tapes that were used to exchange information between banks, and before that, the capacity of the computer punch cards, which had just 80 columns. So, in effect, our payment system in 2015 is still being constrained by the technology of earlier generations. I think it's then difficult to argue that this renewal of our payment system is before time. This new system will allow Australians to transfer money to one another almost instantly, no matter who they bank with. It will remove the need to know someone's BSB to make a payment, so just a phone number or an email address will do. And we'll no longer be limited to just 18 characters in describing the payment. Instead, we'll be able to send a wealth of information with our payments. The industry is working very hard on building this new system. It's a very significant piece of work. It involves the expenditure of hundreds of millions of dollars, and the timeline is tight. But when finished, it will form the backbone of many of our payment systems over the next few decades. The Reserve Bank is closely involved in all this work. It's played a major role in establishing the broad direction of the industry's efforts. It's building a core piece of infrastructure that will allow the payments to be settled in real time. And it's building the capability for our own customers, primarily the Australian government, to use this new payment system. The second area of focus in the area of payment system is the ongoing review of the regulation of the card payment system. Earlier in 2015, we released an issues paper inviting submissions on a broad range of topics in this area, and a number of these were also discussed in the Financial System Inquiry. The topic that has attracted most attention is the concerns about excessive surcharging on credit cards. In its response to the FSI, the government indicated that we'll ban excessive surcharging and will give the ACCC enforcement powers in this area. An important element for us here is to define what exactly constitutes excessive surcharging, and this is an issue that we're currently working on, and we're also working closely with Treasury and with the ACCC as the necessary legislation gets developed. Another topic in this general area is the level of interchange benchmarks in the card payment systems and the compliance arrangements that relate to these benchmarks. Here we're continuing to consult on whether it's in the public interest for these benchmarks to be lowered. And in terms of compliance, perhaps not surprisingly, the schemes have become increasingly adroit at maximising interchange fees while still complying with the benchmarks. And as a result, we've seen interchange pricing become increasingly complex, and there's very significant price discrimination between merchants. We've also seen the schemes introduce and promote new high-interchange, high-reward cards, with merchants typically having little, or in some cases no, visibility over the interchange fees that apply when a specific card's presented. So how best to deal with these developments, including the compliance whether the compliance arrangements can be simplified and whether the transparency of the system can be further improved, is an important area of work over the next year. The third area of our regulatory responsibilities I just want to touch on is the one area where the RBA still effectively acts as a prudential supervisor, and that's for central counterparties and security settlement facilities, so-called financial market infrastructures, or FMIs. Since the financial crisis, the prudential regulation of these entities has taken on added focus, both here in Australia and around the world. This reflects the critical role that these entities play in the smooth functioning of the financial system, and this role was reinforced following the agreement by the G20 nations to clear all standardised OTC derivatives through central counterparties. Now, while globally the transition to central counterparties has been slower than was originally agreed, there has been very significant progress. In Australia, the majority of new trades in standardised interest rate derivatives are now cleared centrally, and the shift has been supported by recently introduced legislation that provide for mandated central clearing of interest rate derivatives in a range of currencies. Over the next year, the RBA's priorities for work in this area really fall in two areas. The first is one that Wayne touched on, and that's the development of more robust crisis management arrangements here for FMIs. The RBA currently sets standards that these FMIs are required to meet. I think these standards should provide us with a high degree of assurance regarding the stability of these entities, but they can't and they don't rule out the possibility that these entities could experience severe financial difficulties, which could ultimately prejudice the stability of our financial system. And given this, it's important that appropriate arrangements are in place to deal with troubles in these FMIs if these troubles should ever develop. Now, the current arrangements in this area were considered by the FSI and have been under review by the Council of Financial Regulators for some time. In its response to the inquiry, the government endorsed the implementation of a framework to provide regulators with clear powers in the event that an FMI got into trouble. This is consistent with an earlier proposal consulted on by the government to make the Reserve Bank the resolution authority for central counterparties and security settlement facilities based in Australia. Under the proposed arrangements, the RBA would be able to give formal directions to FMIs and to intervene if severe financial distress occurred, causing wide disruption to the financial system. And one way that the Reserve Bank might do this is to be able to appoint a statutory manager to operate the critical functions of the FMI for a period of time. And this is really similar to the framework that's already in place for banks, that's the responsibility of APRA. Developing these crisis resolution arrangements for FMIs is a significant task. Material changes in legislation will be required, and the RBA is developing detailed strategies and operational arrangements that would help this work. These efforts are drawing on international work on resolution strategies that's led by the FMI, as well as similar work that's been undertaken for the banks. The second and related priority in this area is similar to one that both Greg and Wayne have touched on, and that's cyber resilience. By their very nature, FMIs are heavily dependent on technology and on connections with external parties, and this dependency is increasing all the time. At the same time, the nature of the cyber threats has evolved rapidly, and we're seeing increasingly sophisticated methods being used by those attempting to cause disruptions. The RBA is working closely with the FMIs that it supervises to better understand the nature of their cyber resilience. And as part of this work, the RBA and ASIC asked the ASX to conduct a self-assessment of its cybersecurity practices for the FMIs that it operates. This assessment concluded that the ASX practices were generally aligned with the upper tiers of maturity levels under internationally used cybersecurity standards. But this is an area that does need to be continually watched, as both Greg and Wayne said, and there's a considerable amount of work going on at the international level here, and the RBA is closely involved in this work. As a financial institution itself, the RBA also sees the increasing prevalence and the sophistication of cyber attacks. And as Australia's central bank, we've made our own very significant investments to address these risks. In the area of payment infrastructure, we're undertaking work now to strengthen further the resilience of the Reserve Bank Information and Transfer System, most of you probably know as RITS. This system is owned and operated by the Reserve Bank, and it really lies at the heart of Australia's payment system. So, David, I will finish there, and I look forward to participating in the panel discussion. Thank you.
Save you getting up and down, Phil. Why don't you grab a seat there, and if I could ask Greg and Wayne to join us up on stage. I think enormous amount of material there for us to all digest, but a lot of common themes as well, and it's fantastic to see all regulators talking about forward-looking, talking about innovation and the way that regulation can actually support innovation in our sector as well. I'm going to ask a couple of questions just to kick things off, but I know there'll be many in the audience that would be keen to ask a question, so if you can prepare those, and I'm sure some roving microphones will be coming around shortly. But just to kick off a question to perhaps all the panel to start with, and it's obviously topical given the government's just come out with their response to the financial system inquiry, but now that the approach and action plan has been delivered, what sort of legacy do you think the inquiry is actually going to leave our industry? I'm happy to kick off anywhere there. Thanks. Philip?
Yeah, and I think the other observation I would make is that the inquiry came to the conclusion that the current system was working well. It was a point that Lynn made right at the start, and that the many other countries have had kind of very difficult experiences with financial regulation over the past decade or so, and we have not. And I think this is something that can we can gloss over too easily when thinking about the changes that inquiry talk about. Our current system actually works well, and we should take considerable comfort from that. The increased focus on resilience of the banking system, efficiency of the super system, and innovation in the financial sector, I think, are all spot on. And these are areas of kind of continual improvement, but in a system that's actually working pretty well.
Great, thank you. I wouldn't mind developing or trying to tease out a little bit about a theme that we heard all three of you touch on. That's really around innovation. Greg, you talked about the new innovation hub that ASIC's established to help fintech startups navigate the regulatory system and reduce red tape. And I think we'd be keen to hear from all of you, actually, how you're thinking about innovation, the implications of the change that you're seeing with the rise of fintech, and particularly, I suppose, the role of the regulator. You know, we heard, I think, from you, Greg, this sort of calibrated approach as an organisation grows, but I'd be interested to sort of tease out perhaps a few more comments around how you propose to regulate new entrants as well as existing market participants as they try to innovate as well.
Well, as I said, I think that in a digital age, I think the way laws apply and regulation applies, we need to rethink a little bit because, you know, in the digital age, you have a lot of innovation occurring. Some of it may take off, some of it may not. And I think you've almost got to have an environment where almost you know, you do allow things in the sandbox to evolve with sort of perhaps a limited approach. As I said, you know, probably too small to really care, so a basic approach. And then as they grow, you think about a more evolved approach. And I do think, as I said, a more graduated approach is appropriate. I do think that if we think about things like blockchain that are evolving and how, you know, what that might do, as I said, to clearing, settlement, exchanges itself, you know, flexibility and agility are going to be really important. And especially, I think, every major country in the world at the moment, it's a competition and the digital environment. So if you want to actually not just follow but lead the world, I think you're going to have to be a lot more flexible and adaptable to make sure your economy can respond. But again, make sure that you fundamentally make sure that you maintain trust and confidence in investors. And I said one of the things that I think you've got to take some of the elements of digitisation, like what I call customer regulation, that feedback loop. Perhaps you can use some things of the digital environment perhaps to offset your traditional things you may think about. So I do think it is a new way of thinking, actually, and it's also global. It's not just you need to be seeing what other countries are doing, because the internet is global. So it's important that you actually work, you watch and you work collaboratively with other countries is also important. So yeah, I think it's just part of that evolution that is occurring at the moment.
Philip, would you like to add something to that?
Well, I just reinforce this idea that this graduated approach must be kind of really central to how we all approach this. And you talk to people in the industry, and some people have fantastic ideas of how this might develop. You talk about kind of the blockchain and the distributed ledger, and you know, in 10 years' time, this could be reshaping everything. So we've got to be open to that possibility.
Exactly.
And we've got to make sure that the regulations we put in place don't preclude something that might ultimately be to our collective advantage. So kind of this graduated approach. Mm. And this is something in the payment system board, the Reserve Bank has kind of is very keenly aware of, that the approach to regulation is only to regulate if there's a clear public policy case that can't be solved through other means. The other observation I'd make about innovation, and this comes from my experience in the payment system, that coordination is often required for innovation. Mm. And coordination amongst competitors. So we need kind of mechanisms to do that without damaging competition. And I think in the payment system, we've seen some progress there with the Australian Payments Council developing. But I think that applies in other areas as well. So we need not just get carried away with the possibilities of new ideas, but actually how do we get industry to implement new ideas kind of on a cost-effective and effective basis.
That's why I think the Innovation Hub is very important, that you're actually talking to innovators and saying, well, look, actually, one of the things about our Innovation Hub is we almost say to them, don't go and with lawyers and then sort of create something and then come to us. Come and talk to us early on, because often these people don't have a lot of capital. So we actually are trying to encourage them, try and help them develop their ideas within, the framework. I think I agree with Phil.